Good morning on such a rainy, gray, autumnal day. My husband isn't here this morning because he's bailing out our basement. So I hope none of you are having to do that today, but that's going to be on my, that's what I'm going to do this afternoon. So not what I would have expected at the end of the school term. So I go to the gym. I don't know how many of you guys go to the gym, but I try and go a couple of times. My target is to go a couple of times a week during my lunch break. And I love going to spin classes, partly because I get a deadline. I have to be there to show up when the class starts, and it finishes on time, and I feel like I've done something and completed it. And the gym that I go to down at Coxwell and Girard has an amazing instructor who teaches Thursdays at lunch. So that's a little pitch for her. If you ever want to come to spin class with me, just let me know. I'd love to go with you. Anyway, so the Thursday lunchtime class is my absolute favorite, and I really try hard not to miss it. And for those, has anybody been to a spin class? A few? A handful. Okay. So a spin class is one where you're in a room with a bunch of people sitting on stationary bikes, and they play loud music, and you do interval training. So you do, you go really fast, and then you go uphill and downhill, and meanwhile the beat is going boom, 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 boom. And I just love it. Anyway, so this is spin class. So one of the reasons I like it is because you do it in a group. You get really sweaty. It's good for your heart and everything. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was at my favorite class on Thursday, and we were coming to the end of the class. It's probably one of the best bits of the class is the end, right? And the instructor, who is always the sweatiest of us all, started to bring us into the warm-down phase towards the end. And she said something like, "Wouldn't it be great if we could always just do the warm-down and skip the rest?" Well, I know exactly what she meant, because it would be so much better, I guess, not to have to work so hard, not to have to push yourself physically. Maybe I'm just revealing a lot about myself here, but anyway. Having your muscles ache, right? Having to push yourself. And I don't know the science that's behind it, really, but I do know for myself that I get a unique feeling when I've exercised. I can only get it when I've exercised. And I looked it up online. We get endorphins, and we get dopamine and serotonin when we exercise. And I don't know if you can get that feeling if you inject those chemicals. I don't know if it's possible. But I do know that it feels really great when a class is over, and I've worked really hard. But wouldn't it be better if I could just kind of skip the hard work and feel good, get the buzz at the end? The thing is, though, that the buzz that you get from exercise doesn't last. It lasts for a brief time, but it doesn't go on and on. And exercise is a unique thing because you get cause and effect. You work out and you feel good, right? You sleep better, your stress levels go down, that kind of thing. You work out, you tend to feel better. But what about the rest of our lives, right, beyond exercise? Wouldn't it be better if we could just enjoy the good stuff, the good life, heavy on the buzz and light on the tough stuff? And so this morning, I'd like to take some time to consider what Paul proposes to us this morning in his letter to the Corinthians, and focusing and really zoning in on suffering and comfort. Do they always have to go together? And is there any purpose to it? By the time Paul is writing this second letter that we have, Paul has been to the bottom and back. It's been so bad that he describes it as a sentence of death. Heavy black darkness, not a shred of hope left, too heavy to go on. That voice inside saying it would be easier if he ended it now, right? He says he despaired of life itself. Was it depression? Was it a breakdown? Was it imprisonment? Torture? All of the above. Paul doesn't give us anything more than what we have in his letter, but his suffering is as great as if a judge had given him a death sentence, condemned him to death. He had hit rock bottom. And after all this happened to Paul, there are people in Corinth challenging his authority. They said because he suffered so greatly, he couldn't possibly be an apostle. He was disqualified from ministry because of his suffering. Now, what lay behind this criticism? Well, I'm going to take a guess. That they believed that Paul's weakness showed an absence of God's love, an absence of God's blessing. If we think back to the blind man in John 9, right? Jesus' friends asked Jesus, who sinned, Jesus? The blind man himself or his parents? Why was he born blind? So they made a direct cause and effect link between his blindness and were trying to say that the cause was sin. They believed that God had removed his blessing from the blind man to punish him for sinful behavior. We know what happens, right? That Jesus heals the blind man. He loves him, Jesus, God's son. So we know that's not the case. But this was what was happening in Corinth too. Paul's critics said that his suffering was a sign that God wasn't with him. God had removed his blessing. Paul couldn't qualify to be an apostle. No, 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 Paul writes. This dark time actually leads Paul to experience God's redeeming love in a transforming way. Paul, he says, has to set aside relying on himself to try and scarper out of the darkness on his own. Instead, and he's very explicit, he has to rely on God. Out of that darkness, because of God, he could see hope. Just enough light to see his way out of darkness and into hope. This hope is firmly, firmly, firmly grounded on Jesus. God raised his son from the dead, and out of that darkness, Paul could see hope. Because Paul grounds his hope on the resurrection. He looks at his own experience through the perspective of what Jesus did on the cross. If God can raise the dead, what can't he do for me? And note the language that Paul uses. He uses past, but then he uses a lot of future. Right? He delivered us, and he will deliver us, and he will deliver us again. God is at work in and through the difficulties in our lives. And as low as we can get, Paul draws on us to rely on the power of the resurrection to comfort and to heal in the present. And also to hope that one day we too will live the resurrected life with no more tears, no more sickness, no more death. It's actually about sharing. And I'll tell you why. So Paul rebuffs his critics. Not only, do his sufferings not disqualify him from being an apostle, they actually are the way that God goes about strengthening his followers. Paul says that his experiences have given him the opportunity to know God's comfort for himself. And then, really like a relay race where you pass the baton, right? Paul is able to share that comfort he has received from God with others. Right? And then the comforted can go on to be comforters. And he writes, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. We all need the comfort of the gospel. One person sometimes speaking to another, speaking words into their lives to change the situation, maybe giving courage, new hope, a new direction, insight, fellowship. This is comfort. It's not making someone feel comfortable or distracting them or avoiding the suffering or pretending it's not real. giving them a short-term fix of dopamine. Rather, it is being able to see into the lives of our brothers and sisters and into the lives of those in the wider world and see that God is at work in our midst and even in the strange and troubling times in our lives. God is still at work. That comfort can bring us to the point where we can see a way forward. And that way forward is what we call hope. On him we have set our hope that he will deliver us again, says Paul. Hope is a consequence, an expression of faith, not wishful thinking, but confidence in God's promises for the future based on his faithfulness time after time in the past. Suffering and comfort go together for Paul. And we experience suffering. It is the terrible truth. And I don't know all of your life stories, but I expect you have stories of suffering. I expect you have stories that are finished, and some of you have stories that still have not ended. Suffering does not automatically improve your life, right? We know that. And indeed, the culture that we live in, the wider culture that we live in, I think, presents suffering as an interruption of freedom. Suffering reduces our choices, and that's bad. And I think we're going to see this played out as the wider conversation continues about assisted suicide. And I'm not going to go there today, but I think it's something for us to consider. Christians believe something different about suffering. Paul urges us to see that God uses our suffering to comfort those who need it. We who suffer can be comforters to others who suffer, sharing the hope of the good news. Now, can God use suffering in our lives? Well, I'm going to lean on Tim Keller. He makes some really good arguments, and I wanted to share them with you. He teases the issue out and comes out with at least four ways that God uses suffering in our lives. First, he says, suffering transforms our perceptions about ourselves. It shows us how vulnerable we are, right? And how dependent we are. It gives us the opportunity for self-examination. And it shows us our limits. As much as we would like, we are not superheroes. It can show us our weaknesses. It can show us our shallow faith, our meanness, our petty jealousies. So, for example, do you know that it is not uncommon for women who have had a miscarriage to suffer from great jealousy of women who are pregnant as a result of suffering? Second, suffering can cause us to re-examine the things we value, the things that we put up on a pedestal in our lives. So, for example, if we lose a job, and that job was really, really important to us, and we got a lot of our own self-worth from that job, and that is gone, then our self-worth is gone. And then we're going to suffer because we've put too much importance on that thing. But that suffering may help us to see that we need to recalibrate our lives and our desires. Third, Keller says, suffering can strengthen our relationship with God and to God like nothing else. And as Paul says, it makes us rely not on ourselves but God. Suffering can be like a litmus test. How much of our faith in God is rooted in the things that he gives us? How much of our faith is rooted in what he is doing for us? Gimme, gimme, gimme. And how many of us, when we've been suffering, have resented God so much that we've turned our back on him? How many of us have been dry in our prayer life and we've just shut down? It happens, it's normal, but it happens. John Newton, the hymn writer and slave trader, from the 18th century, he later became a Christian, wrote a letter to a friend who was suffering from grief. I think she had lost her spouse. And he wrote this to her: "Above all, keep close to the throne of grace. If we seem to get no good by attempting to draw near him, we may be sure we shall get none by keeping away from him." So, the first 3 points: suffering transforms our attitude to ourselves. It can. It can show us when good things in our lives have become too important. And it can strengthen our relationship to God. And Keller's final point: we need to know about suffering in our own lives if we can be of any use to other people. Sometimes suffering can make us hard and we get stuck there and we stay bitter and brittle and we don't move on. That happens, right? And I already said, suffering doesn't necessarily improve us. So sometimes we get stuck. But this doesn't happen to Paul, right? We read his letter this morning, so a couple of thousand years later, we are reaping the benefits of his experience of suffering. Thanks be to God. His suffering drives him into God's arms, and he uses that experience to be a comfort to others and to us. When we are in deep suffering and we reach out to God, we get to see deeper views of God's mercy and tenderness and grace. And if you haven't been down there, you don't know. But when you have, you know how deep his love is for us. So when we've been at rock bottom, we will have more compassion and a wider range of insight into human frailty and weakness than we would have otherwise. And this has a wider implication too, right? Because not only can individuals provide comfort one to another when people are suffering, well, sufferers become comforters. And it has an amazing implication for our community when we gather, right? The church becomes a place, a community of profound consolation, a place to get enormous comfort and support for your suffering, where people can find themselves growing, right? Where they have hope out of the darkness going forward and becoming, being transformed into the people that God has made them to be. That's you and me. So it's not a personal, private thing. It is a corporate thing. Now, suffering and comfort go together, says Paul. And Paul is not calling us to seek suffering, and I am not calling you to seek suffering. I hate suffering. But when I look back on my life so far, the times when I've hit rock bottom, and there have been a few, those times when I've been on my knees and absolutely desperate, those have been for me the times when I've experienced God's love for me in the deepest and most profound ways. And I do not want to suffer again. But I know that God is the one who raises the dead. And he has delivered me from deadly peril. And I have set my hope in him that he will deliver me again and again. And I pray that this would be true for us all in this place.